Sì. Sì. Buongiorno a tutti.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Shalom. And welcome to the Library of the Senate of the Italian Republic. I'm delighted to have been involved in the organization of this meeting, which focuses on very topical issues that were already at the heart of another seminar held a year ago. At the time, I was in hospital, so I was unable to attend that particular event. This year, we are privileged to have with us some eminent speakers. I'm looking forward to hearing from them, and I think it's a particularly significant time for us to be holding this seminar, given what is happening in the Middle East in general and in Israel in particular. The so-called Arab Spring holds out considerable hope, but it also has given rise to further uncertainty and instability in a number of countries. Obviously, it is our duty to hope that in as many countries as possible, there may be a peaceful solution to disputes. We hope that peace may prevail in the Middle East. Only 2 weeks ago, I had the opportunity to meet an important Syrian dissident who told me that their dream was a free, democratic Syria that wants to be friends with Israel and has at heart the interest of its citizens and therefore wants to live peacefully and harmony in the region. This is something, of course, that we all hope may be the case. However, we should not ignore the threats and dangers. The possibility that the Palestinian Authority might opt for a unilateral declaration of independence in September is something which must be met with a firm no on the part of free-thinking democratic countries. Democratic countries must say no to such a possibility of a unilateral declaration. And I think that this is probably going to be one of the main issues that is going to be discussed in the course of today's meeting. We fortunately are no longer hearing about the intention to bring Israel back within the 1967 borders. Fortunately, no one is really making that claim. We know very well that we have to go back to the 1910s and 1920s, and we know only too well that at the time there were other conditions, other premises for the establishment and creation of the State of Israel. I think, come to the end of my introductory remarks. I would like to thank all those who have accepted our invitation. I'd like to thank Edda Folgarolo and all of the speakers, as well as all of the members of the audience. And I know that there are going to be some very important presentations today, which I know will be appreciated by all. Thank you once again for your presence here this afternoon, and I wish you all a profitable and successful meeting. Good morning, Good afternoon, rather. I would like to thank Senator Malan, first and foremost, for having supported us in organizing this important event for Israel. I would like to thank Senator Luigi Compagna, who has done his very best to be with us today. And I would also like to thank the Honorable Magdi Cristiana Alhamma. He left Brussels at 12:30, so he literally flew here. And fortunately, he's here on time. I would like to once again renew my thanks to all those who have come here from afar. This is a very important meeting, and I would like to thank those who've come from my city, Padua. I would like to thank the group of violinists from Cittadella. They have come here especially to contribute to this exchange. They have begun to play the music of Israel. I would like to thank all those who are here from Pescara, Florence. I would like to thank those who have come from Turin and Naples, Rome. I would like to thank our Swiss and Israeli friends too, of course. So there's a very long list of people who have shown great love for Israel coming here. So thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. And I don't want to take up any more time. As an Italian citizen, as someone born in Italy, I felt it my duty to say a few words about the relationship between Italy and the Jews, Israel. I'd like to start with a PowerPoint presentation. I'm not technically competent, I'm afraid. I hope you can see. Is it legible, says the speaker?
Okay. Scusa. Allora, questo è il tema, tutti voi lo avete ricevuto.
You know that this is the title of this seminar, and what we see here is a tablet dating back to Pontius Pilate. We love history and the way in which we can observe the relationship between Rome and the Jewish people. We know that unfortunately Romans fought against the Jews, and as Italians we really feel it is our commitment to try and to, let's say, somehow make up for this. In 1961 this archaeological discovery was made confirming the presence of Pontius Pilate as a governor, and this is one of the most extraordinary findings, and it is possible to observe this in Rome, Titus's arch, and according to the Romans it was an honor to have stolen the menorah and to have destroyed the temple in 70 AD. So really, it is our duty as Italians to change things, and certainly not continue along this tradition. And then, of course, how can we not mention Hadrian, the Roman emperor that I think we're all familiar with, in 133, 134, 135 AD, the emperor decided to stop a rebellion of the Jews who were simply trying to safeguard their religion, and they did not want to succumb to paganism thou shalt have one God is something that they felt was their duty to preserve as a Moses given precept. And so they rebelled against the Romans because they wanted to be able to continue. In their tradition. And then the emperor decided to wipe out all of the vestiges of the Jewish people. And the dominion is something which was then upheld by other rulers. And the emperor chose to completely wipe out the traces of Jewish tradition. The name Jerusalem was changed, as was the new, as was the name of Jewish territories, and this is the origin of the name Palestine. So the origins of the current problems are in this name, which has been surrounded by so many misunderstandings and problems, and this unfortunately is due to the Emperor Hadrian. This is a map, a geopolitical map. In red, you see the Galilee, Idumea, Judea, Samaria, the Jewish territories. This is 63 AD. And this bears witness to the territories at the time. And here, to the right, we see in red the area known as Palestine. So there was a truly historic change. Anybody who's familiar with the Bible or other texts will know that at times there's a misconception. There is no such thing as Palestine in the times of King David. The concept of Palestine only dates back to 135 AD, whereas, of course, this is long after King David's times. And then there was another period during which Italy was guilty of other wrongdoings, the Inquisition. Part of the territories of the south were subjected to the Inquisition, and we're talking about fertile lands that were very wealthy. It seems unthinkable, and yet these territories were penalized economically and historically, and the Jews, in many cases, migrated to the north. Many went to Tuscany, others went to Veneto, but they abandoned the south. Many Bibles, many Talmud were burnt, precisely in an attempt to wipe out the traditions of the Jewish people, the writings of the Jewish people. My region invented the ghettos in 1516. The first ghetto was established in Venice. The formerly free Jewish population of Venice was forced to live in a ghetto. And this comes from the word getto, which was a foundry. So the term ghetto, in fact, comes from Venice, my region, my part of the world. And we're here to try and change things. And hopefully, Italy will take a different, totally different course. And then we come to Napoleonic times, characterized by nationalism. And we know that from that time onwards, every time the Pesach was celebrated, the Jews said, next year we will be in Jerusalem. And finally, fortunately, we witnessed this rebirth, this dream with Theodor Herzl, who was able to found Zionism, the movement which made it possible to purchase land and to create a Jewish hearth in the Palestinian territory. This is the Balfour Declaration, November 2nd, 1917. I apologize if I'm repeating things that are probably known to you, but this is a good way of remembering why we're here. And what we see here is a very special document indeed. It is a telegram in which the Zionist movement was all given permission to purchase land. So there was no theft of land, as some say. Stones, rocks, desert lands were purchased. We're not talking about fertile lands here. The fertile land at the beginning was still property of the sultans and then the owners. So essentially, the Arab populations, and obviously we're talking about the years of the mandate. And this is the promised land in the Balfour Declaration and in the San Remo Conference. I cannot go into this because I know that Dr. Jacques Gaultier is a great expert on this topic. And this is the land that was then given. And then Churchill decided to draw a line and exclude this part of land that was given to the Arab friends. This is where Jordan was to be established, Transjordan to start with, and then Jordan subsequently. And this is how the Jews were able to find money to buy land. This was a money bank with the Star of David, which was distributed to all the nations and every family, every year, every organization, every group around the world collected money, which was then donated to those who were doing the Aliyah and who settling in Palestine. Here we have experts from Keren Hayesod, so I won't go into this. These are the organizations which bought the land, a bank was established, and then the Hebron massacre. And this was the beginning of the first pogrom, the first persecution on the part of the Arabs. There had been conflicts, but this was a pogrom committed in Palestine. Who was behind this? Ajamina al-Hussein. You can't see him, but he is at the middle of this group. And his intention was to stop the purchase of land and to put an end to at the Aliyah in Palestine. And he succeeded in this because he organized terrorist attacks throughout Palestine, fighting against those families that had settled there and those who had purchased land. And he also fought against the British Army. He is wearing that white headdress, Ajanin al-Sain, a Palestinian Arab born in Jerusalem. He became Mufti of Jerusalem. And from that moment, he had total control of the situation and planned terrorist operations against the newly born Zionism. And Europe, unfortunately, at the time, witnessed an upsurge in anti-Semitism, the Zionist movement, was established, but at the same time, opposition developed. I forgot to mention the fact that al-Hussein succeeded in controlling the coastline and prevented the landing of the vessels carrying migrants. And then a number of white papers by the British government put an end to migration. And this is a forgery, a real forgery. This is the famous dialogue between Machiavelli and Montesquieu. This was an inspiration for a book on the right. The Elders of Sion. And this was written by Maurice Joly to protest Napoleon III, but this was then turned into a form of anti-Semitism, and anti-Semitism changed. Anti-Semitism from that moment onwards was no longer religious. Jews were seen as dominating the world, and that's when we begin to see those cartoons of Jews with their pockets bursting with money, striding across the globe. And we know that this was used by Mussolini during the enactment of the racial laws in 1938. Mussolini drew up a complete list of surnames of Jewish families living in Italy, and this isn't in alphabetical order. The latest version of Elders published in 1938 contained an attachment with a list of Jewish surnames. And then during the Nazi fascist era, it became very easy to capture the Jews on the basis of this ready-made list. The racial laws I mentioned, 1938. Let's go back to Benjamin al-Hussein. He decided to forge an alliance with Hitler and Mussolini because he wasn't making any headway. He entered into agreements with Hitler and with Mussolini, and he was also funded by Mussolini. He was greeted in Rome as a great head of state, and he was tributed with recognition and received weapons and money to fight against the Aliyah and the Zionist movement to stop this flight of Jews from Europe, Jews who were fleeing persecution. They were captured everywhere, and Benjamin Hussein decided to enter into an agreement. He wanted something to be done in Tel Aviv, too. He wanted to poison the water in Tel Aviv. And this is something which Mussolini funded. And I have to say that this is obviously a terrible thing indeed. And here we see him with Himmler to reach an agreement to stop the Zionist movement and to make sure that the Jews were doomed. Here we see him examining his army. He had the famous Bosnian Muslim SSs, so Europe and the Balkans history, as we know, was unfortunately characterized by these SS troops who hunted down Jews and partisans. Here we see him again, and this is a poster to draft Bosnian soldiers. So history has confirmed that over 100,000 people died on account of Benjamin al-Husseini, and thousands of children wanted to emigrate to Palestine, and he wrote secret letters to Himmler and others and said these orphan children ought to be taken to a safe place. And this was a code for Auschwitz, as we know. This man was never captured after the war, but he invented and he inspired the new jihad. And he was one of the inspiring figures for the Muslim Brotherhood. He traveled everywhere to create a pan-Islamic empire. And the situation we have now is due to the evil of Haji Amin al-Hussein. Now, it's important for us to understand history and change the course of history. We have to understand the origins of Palestine. We have to understand the reason for this hatred against Jews. And we have to understand why Italy must take a new stand in support of Israel. Thank you.
Scusatemi. Adesso noi vogliamo.
So we would now like to continue. I'd like to introduce Thomas Sandel. Thomas Sandel is the founder of Coalition for Israel. So I would like to give you the floor, Thomas.
Here. Okay. Thank you. I'm going to keep it very short as an introduction to our next speaker, but perhaps for 2-3 minutes to share a little bit about the mission that we are in. European Coalition for Israel is a non-Jewish lobby group, advocacy group in support of Israel with a headquarter in Brussels. We have three pillars that we build our activities on as a Christian group: to pray for the peace of Jerusalem, to educate, and to advocate. The reason we are here today is to educate. As we have engaged with lots of members of parliaments throughout Europe, we've seen that the knowledge of the history of Israel is very thin. And it seems almost like the world was created in 1967, which we know is not the truth. And we believe in particular when it comes to the historical and the legal rights of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, that we need a serious approach to education. The context is also very important. We started this mission together with Dr. Jacques Gauthier, with Andrew Tucker, in the Dutch Parliament the last day of May. On Jerusalem Day in the European Parliament, Dr. Gauthier had a presentation which was very well attended. We've been to Berlin, to the Bundestag. Next week we will be in Paris and in London. So I want you to see the context why we are here. Because what Dr. Gauthier is going to share in just a few minutes is of such importance, in particular with an eye to the unilateral declaration in September. I mentioned the third pillar of our work is advocacy, which means to speak out on behalf of someone else. This is why it is important for us as Europeans, as Gentiles, as Christians, to be the advocates for Israel for such a time as this. And we're very honored to have such strong partners in Italy, in particular my very good friend Magdi from the European Parliament, but now with new friends, and with your parliament here, with your government. I really want, as a Finn and as a European, to say that we are very proud of Italy. We have a very short message that we are conveying politically as a group. That is, one, to say no to a unilateral declaration, yes to negotiations. There's no other way to peace than to sit down and talk. The second is to say we believe the best guarantee for an open Jerusalem, which is open for people of all faith and conviction, is a Jerusalem which is under Jewish sovereignty. And the history will have proven that this is the only way to make sure that we have a truly what people will call shared capital. Having said that, let me refocus the attention to the right of me. A very distinguished international human rights lawyer. A knight has been knighted by the French government. Jacques Chirac, very well respected, not only in Canada, he's a native Canadian, but also throughout the world. I think a big miracle happened in the European Parliament on the 1st of June when he managed to capture the audience for a full 50 minutes, which is unheard of in the European Parliament. But what he is to share is of such importance, and the insights that he has been given after 25 of research is something very unique, what we wanted to bring to all of you here in Rome. So, ladies and gentlemen, would you welcome Dr. Jacques Gauthier.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here today. I've been to Rome before. It's a very special place to me. And my obligation today, my mandate, my task, is a difficult one because it took me, over 25 years, as I was doing a number of other things, to put this document together. It is 10 kilos, 1,300 pages, 3,200 footnotes, and I'm going to try to summarize this in 45 minutes today. Rome is a city of miracles, and I need a miracle today. More importantly, what I have to share in this defining moment of history is so significant. There have been other defining moments which I'm going to talk about. World War I and its aftermath. World War II and its aftermath. 1967 until the end of the 20th century and now. I want to underline today the pivotal role played by the nation of Italy during the First World War and after the First World War. A war that was supposed to result in new freedom and justice. Decisions were made in the years that immediately followed the World War, the First World War, which altered the destiny of mankind, and in particular the Middle East. I am an international lawyer, a human rights advocate. I have spent years of my life fighting for the rights of children, the rights of minorities in Canada, more recently going to China, dealing with human rights issues in China. What matters to me is justice. I'd like to be involved in the pursuit of justice. And today I'm talking about the rights of the Jewish people. And I'm talking about these rights from a legal perspective. Many understand that there is a religious connection, a religious foundation to the claims of the Jewish people in respect to the Holy Land. Many understand that historically they've been there before. I'm here to talk to you about legal rights, title to property, title to territory. There's no doubt that the issue of Jerusalem is one of the most controversial, delicate, complex issues of all. Bottom line, you don't solve the question of Jerusalem, you solve nothing. If you could solve the question of Jerusalem, a lot of the other issues would come into focus. And yet, this one is the greatest bone of contention. It is so complex. As a lawyer, I have to tell you that facts are always relevant in order to arrive at a good judgment. Whoever comes before you, explains a situation, and gives you only part of the facts, it will result in a distorted and a wrong decision. I want you today to give me the next 45, 50 minutes and hear about the historical events that are the facts that determine the legal rights of the Jewish people on one hand, of the Arab people on the other hand, and the Palestinians. What happened in the events that I'm going to describe resulted in rights for the Jewish people, rights for the Arab people, rights for the Palestinians. What rights? Time is of the essence. It's necessary for me to leave the family that helped me to put this book together, this thesis together. Five women, one wife, four daughters. It's all according to the precepts of the Catholic Church. I'm here, again, third time in less than 2 months in Europe, because time is of the essence. Yes, in September, the General Assembly, around the week of September 18th, may well be asked to make a key decision resulting in another defining moment of history in respect to the declaration of statehood of the Palestinians. The nations will be asked to respond. My hope is that the nation of Italy will respond as it should, taking into consideration the equities, taking into consideration principles of justice. I take the position that the issue of title to Jerusalem, this key component of the problem, has been already decided. In common law, we talk about res judicata. It's nice to speak Latin in this city. In French, we say chose jugée, meaning that at one point in history, those who had the power to make a decision, the power of disposition. If I come to you with a dispute, I can present the problems to you, and you may have absolutely no authority, no jurisdiction to decide. But something happened in the year 1920 in the nation of Italy. A decision was made, a series of decisions were made, resulting in title being granted to different peoples, Jewish people, Arab people. The decision that is being reconsidered by the members of the United Nations today, and many in your own nation, I submit to you have already been dealt with, and those who had the power to decide have made the decisions. You see behind me an outline of the city of Jerusalem today. Please note the yellow. I hope you can see this. I was praying for dark clouds earlier. They haven't come yet, so you could see better. But the little yellow square in the middle is the old city. And if you read the title of my thesis, it focuses on the old city because that's the ultimate issue and bone of contention. And I'll explain why in a moment. My conclusion, after many years of research, is as far as Jerusalem is concerned, and it's relevant to the rest of what is referred to as the disputed territories today, decisions have already been made and title has been given to the Jewish people. But I'm here as a scientist, I'm here as a scholar, I'm here as a jurist, and I must present to you the evidence and the arguments so that you can make your own decision. You can reflect and decide whether these are valid legal conclusions or not. This is about law. There's a great blurring, not only now, but in the last decades, between political arguments and legally founded arguments. Anybody can say, I want it. It ought to be mine. I'm here to tell you what was decided and who is entitled to say today, we have the title. That doesn't take away the right of others to say, no, you have the title, but we'd like it. That's a political argument. But what are the legal foundations? Today, you hear a lot about the 1967 borders. So maybe about a dozen things will be stressed today, and this is one of them. Please help me by listening carefully to this. What is this about? When we refer to the 1967 borders, and you may be aware that in Deauville just a few weeks ago, the G20 members met, or actually it was the G8 that were meeting in Deauville, tried to pass a resolution whereby the group would be supportive of the establishment of a Palestinian state on the basis of 1967 borders. That resolution did not go forth because one member of the group, Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada, blocked it. And you can't have a group decision if one is not in agreement. What's the problem with the 1967 borders? If you look at this green line, what you're looking at really is an armistice line. Let me refer you to this article of a treaty between Israel and Jordan. And I very respectfully submit to you that you don't have to go to law school for many years to understand what that says. Please keep in mind that an armistice line is a line that the parties in a war, in a conflict, choose as to where they're going to end their hostility. And this treaty, relating to the termination of a war between Israel and what was then Transjordan, specifies that there are no provisions in the agreement that in any way shall prejudice the rights, claims, and positions of either party. As a lawyer, I can't go too deeply into this, but there's a chapter in international law that deals with the law of war. It provides for occupation. It tells you what you can do and can't do in times of occupation. The whole idea of this segment of international law is to encourage belligerent parties to stop fighting. You want them to stop killing each other, so you introduce a system whereby you can have a line where you stop fighting, but don't worry. If you agree to stop fighting in this line, it will not have any ramifications, implications, or consequences in terms of title claims in the future. That's what this says. In fact, I have here a copy of the agreement between Israel and Syria in 1949. Today, Israel and Syria are still at war. And in this agreement, it says, the purpose of the armistice demarcation line is not to provide rights to the parties, and it's there's no implication as far as ultimate territorial arrangements which are meant to result from this. I have the treaty between Israel and Lebanon. It says the same thing. So what are the nations trying to do today? They're saying to the Jewish people, they're saying to the state of Israel, never mind all that. You stop fighting on the Green Line, and we're going to use that line and impose a border upon you. As a lawyer, I say to you, we are transgressing in the realm of international law. We're doing something we're not supposed to do, and it could have serious consequences, because the next time there's a conflict and we're trying to end it, one of the parties will say, I don't want to agree to end fighting and to pick an armistice line, because next thing you know, they're going to impose that line in a future negotiation on me as a border line. Armistice lines, borders, not the same thing. Now, most of the people I speak to around the world, I tell them, do you understand what would happen to Jerusalem if you divided Jerusalem on the basis of the Green Line? This is what would happen. The dark blue is what's left of the Jewish Jerusalem. The dark green and the entire old city are the Jewish Palestine, the Palestinian Jerusalem, I should say, and the light green is the adjacent Palestinian state, and the dark, you know, the very light blue is what would be next to the Jewish Jerusalem. So you see that the Jewish Jerusalem would be completely surrounded by the Palestinian state, and three quarters of the of Jerusalem today, excuse me, would be the new Palestinian capital. When we talk about dividing Jerusalem, it's often misunderstood what the implications would be. It's not known that all these blue areas here are Jewish communities which would have to be dismantled, called settlements by the United Nations, by the quartet, which includes Europe, and by many nations in the world. I'm here to say to you that based on the analysis I've done over the last 20 years plus, the Jewish people are not in Jerusalem as settlers. They're not trespassers. They're not occupiers. They're there as of right. They're not wrongfully there. That's a legal reality. And my advice to those who are negotiating with the leadership of Israel and the Jewish people is begin by recognizing the rights that they've been given. Don't deny the rights. You'll get stuck. What rights have they been given? When were they given any rights? Here's an indication of what would happen if Israel maintained sovereignty over all of Jerusalem. Here's what would happen again if the Green Line was used, and if you implement the program and the ideology of Hamas today. If you implement the ideology of Hezbollah today, here's what would happen to Jerusalem. They have refused to give recognition to rights of the Jewish people in respect to any aspect or any component of the Holy Land, including Jerusalem. This is Palestine as viewed by Hezbollah, Hamas, Iran, and many of the Islamic nations. No Jewish state at all. No recognition. The Old City. I'm going to hurry now, but you have to understand why I focus on the Old City. That's a way it can be subdivided today. It's five areas, including the Temple Mount, which is without doubt the most coveted piece of real estate on earth. I could spend 2 hours on the Temple Mount. I can't. Those who say that Jerusalem is holy in Christianity, Islam, and Judaism are right. Those who say that Jerusalem and the Old City are central to Christianity, central to Islam, central in Judaism, this is a falsehood. Jerusalem is central in the Jewish faith. It is central for the Jewish people. I spent years studying the Quran and related books and articles. Mecca is the center of Islam. I didn't say Jerusalem's not holy in Islam. It's not the center. And as far as Christianity is concerned, if you have 17 hours, I'll tell you what's central in Christianity. If you're Roman Catholic, that's my background, the Vatican's important. It's interesting that the Sistine Chapel, just a few miles away from here, was designed after Solomon's Temple. I was surprised visiting it to hear that the exact configurations of that incredible monument is the temple. Why? Because this city, the Vatican, have become very central for those of the Catholic faith. If you're a Protestant and you read the Bible a certain way, there's a new Jerusalem coming, and the old Jerusalem is not so significant. That's another long story. We won't go there today. If you're Christian, there are many answers. Yes, Jerusalem is holy. Yes, Christians visit Jerusalem, and there are pilgrimages, and there are all sorts of things happening. but it's not central the way it is to the Jewish people. The Old City, if you look at Jerusalem in the first century, you will see that it's essentially the same configuration. This is before it was destroyed by the Romans. And then here's Jerusalem after it was reconstructed by as a new city by the Romans. And my wife and I did visit this beautiful monument not too far away from here. And I think the Jewish people have to be somewhat thankful to the Romans. They're not happy that what happened in 70 AD happened. But for those who deny that there was ever a temple, all they need to do is come and visit this monument, and it's a hard thing to deny. I spent a lot of time, I'm peculiar at times, I was reading Josephus, one of the greatest historians of all time. He has an entire chapter on the parade in Rome when the Jewish prisoners and slaves were carrying the emblems that are depicted on the inside of this arch. He was an eyewitness. It happened. Jerusalem in the Crusader days. Look, what is Jerusalem? It's the Old City. I'm a collector of lithographs, and I have a lot of those in my thesis. Here's a lithograph of Jerusalem in the mid-19th century. There's nothing, according to this artist, outside the walls of Jerusalem. Here's a French map that I found of Jerusalem mid-19th century. Nothing outside the walls. What am I saying? Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the Old City until the end of the 19th century. Here's a picture of Jerusalem in the 20th century. I hope you can see it. There's almost nothing outside the walls. How is that relevant today? Those who are discussing the status of Jerusalem, be mindful of this. Want the Old City. For though my Jewish friends here and there, when they say, well, we want peace, we'll divide Jerusalem. Well, if you think you can get peace and that you can divide Jerusalem by giving a little nook of East Jerusalem, which is more Arab-speaking than others, to the Palestinian Authority, well, you're dreaming in living color. No, what matters to all those preoccupied with this vital issue is the Old City. I'm going to skip over that. When you look at the issue of title in law, if you're buying a house, you do a title search. This is the beginning of my analysis on the basis of the legal title that has been given to the Jewish people. Again, tie up your belts. This is going to be a supersonic experience. I'm going to zoom through many very crucial events because we have so little time. Herzl, Basel, Switzerland. Before that, 1896, he publishes his thesis. Note the title, The Jewish State. For those who claim that there's a question mark as to what the Jewish Zionist movement was about, start with this. It's about a Jewish state. Herzl did something very vital. Not only did he publish his thesis, there's something rather unfair about it. He got a doctorate for it, and it's only about 75 pages. Mine is 1,300 pages, and I got a doctorate too. It's not fair. But the key thing that he did, 1897, is that he organized a meeting in Basel, Switzerland. Only 196 Jewish people got together. It doesn't take a lot of people to change the destiny of this world. People of conscience, people of goodwill, when they gather and do what they're supposed to do, never mind the majority, never mind those who take positions because it's convenient, if it's right, we've got to do it. 1897, 196 Jews get together and decide on a program for the establishment of a Jewish state, leading to the Balfour Declaration, which has been mentioned by our host today. Crucial moment from a political point of view. Unbelievable the number of articles and books I read which attribute to this document international legal rights and obligations for Jewish people or others. It was just a declaration of one nation, the British War Cabinet in 1917, in respect to the establishment of a home for the Jews. And if you go back to 1897 at the conference in Basel, it was always understood that home was a synonym for nation. At the time of the conference, 1897, the Turks dominated and controlled and were sovereign over those lands. So how could the Jewish people ask at that point in time for the British government to step in and request the creation of a state in the middle of the Ottomans? But home always meant, national home was another way of saying Jewish state, precisely what Herzl talked about in his thesis. So here, the government of Britain, not one man, not Balfour, the British War Cabinet makes a commitment. What about Italy? He did not make a commitment without consulting Italy first. And this is where I want to bring you back. What I'm telling you now is so forgotten by the Italians and by others. Italy was one of the principal Allied powers. It played a key role in World War One. The victory was in part as a result of the support of the Italian people, the Italian nation. So in 1918, a year after the Balfour Declaration, what had been unofficially approved by the Italians, there's a declaration officially supporting the Balfour Declaration. So here, Italy commits itself for the first time. Follow me. Here's Balfour and the person who received the declaration. I take you now to one of these defining moments of history. I take you to this Quai d'Orsay, which is still there in Paris today. Some of you have been there. Foreign Affairs Department of France is still there. I've been legal counsel to France for 25 years, and I know this place. It looks just about the same today. That's where the nations met during the first 6 months of 1919 after the war to deliberate on the consequences of the acts of the Germans and their allies. At this conference in February of 1919, a delegation of Arabs led by the Hashemites based in Mecca came and presented a case. They wanted a big independent Arab state because the British had made some promises before the war to Faisal and to his family. It's one family. Hussein was in Mecca, there was Abdullah, there was Faisal, and there was another brother. They make submissions, and please note, before making these submissions, they meet with the leader of the Zionist movement, Weizmann, ask for his support, and say they will support the Zionist initiative as they ask the Zionists to support their initiative. In fact, Faisal signs an agreement, which is attached to my thesis, underlining the mutual recognition of these two national movements. Faisal and Weizmann met several times. Here's a meeting in 1918 to discuss supporting each other. How much of history has now been rewritten? All right, here's another key thing. In Paris, who is listening to the submissions? It's the Supreme Council of the principal Allied powers. Don't leave today without remembering this. It's a key piece of this big puzzle, which is so hard to put together. The principal Allied powers were the United States, Wilson, Britain, Lloyd George, France, Clemenceau, Italy, Orlando, and Japan. They are sitting like Court of Appeal judges in Paris, listening to all sorts of submissions relating to the restructuring and reconfiguration of Europe. Now, I'm not here to tell you that all the decisions they made were good decisions. I'm telling you as a lawyer, they were binding decisions. Understand binding? Legally, these decisions resulted in legal realities. Legal realities. The Jews organized themselves. You have to be mindful that in those days there were only about 200,000 Jews in Palestine, 700,000 Arabs. They were promised a state, but were not ready. So here's an advisor of wise men, Sasher, who puts together a whole paper saying, here's how we're going to do it. We're going to have a nation step in as a trustee, as a mandatory, in this case Britain, and they will watch over us while we grow through the process of immigration. The entire underpinning of the documents that followed was immigration, resulting someday in a majority and a state. Wiseman was a key architect. In Paris, with a group of others, he presents the submissions of the Zionist organization. So this, if you're in a courtroom and you've brought your statement of claim, this is what you present to the judges. Your submissions are not binding. It's what you want the judge to recognize and to accept. And the question you have to ask yourself today is, all right, Gautier says these submissions were made. Where are they recognized? Did the nations with the power of disposition in fact accept them? They wanted their historical connection to Palestine recognized. They wanted the right to reconstitute what they used to have. Not a typical new nation. If legally that's recognized, it means we have to look at what they had before in order to properly reconstitute what they want now. This is what reconstitution is all about. They asked for particular territory which happened to line up almost perfectly with the biblical allocations of land. You remember the tribes of Israel and some 2.5 tribes that land on the east side of the Jordan River, the others on the west side of the Jordan River. So what they wanted is enough territory so that they could recreate and reconstitute and reestablish what was meaningful historically, what was meaningful from a religious point of view. It's a demand. It's a political claim. Here is a political claim which has no legal validity until it is recognized. Was it recognized? One of the pillars of the legal arguments I'm presenting to you today is Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations. I spend 3 seconds on this. That's where the whole new idea and concept of international trust is created. What comes out of Wilson's ideas is that instead of doing what the nations like this one and others always did, you beat up someone, you conquer someone, you annex and take over. Wilson is saying, we've had such a horrible war, the greatest war of all times, let's do it differently. And that's where this whole thing of a sacred trust comes up. And I submit respectfully to you today that the principles linked to the sacred trust of civilization mentioned here is still relevant in determining the rights of the Jewish people in respect to Jerusalem, in respect to the rest of the Holy Land today. Now, why am I saying to you that these few nations had all the power? Look at this, another example. This is reconfiguration in Europe. And you'll see that it's Bulgaria that's going to be losing territory. You have to distinguish between the principal allied powers, including Italy, and the other allied powers. If you look at Article 48, who gets title? It's the five nations. Remember, when I look for title, there's another Latin principle, nemo dat quod non habet. You can't give what's not yours. Did these nations have the right to give to the Arabs what they gave in respect to the Ottoman territories? Did they have the right to do that in respect to Palestine? Here's a Treaty of Versailles. Who gets the rights? You know, this it took me so long to figure this one out. Who gets it? It's these particular nations. Principal allied powers, remember, Italy is one of the five. Here's the Treaty of Trianon, another neighborhood of Paris where I lived for 10 years. And you'll see again, same five nations get the title. This involves Hungary. And here's a map, which I came up with, not mine, but somebody else's, which shows transfers of territories. This is a key thing. The decisions of these five powers were binding, resulting in a reconfiguration of Europe. And some of you here today would probably say to me, well, I think those decisions were not good decisions. I'm not here to argue that with you. I'm just saying there were binding decisions. Whether they were good or bad decisions, they were legal decisions. The Ottoman territories in Paris, and this is where it gets confusing to a lot of people, and I had trouble with this too. They've heard the submissions of the Zionist organization, they heard the Arab submissions, but who made the decision and when? They left Paris midway through 1919, did not decide then. Instead, they reconvene, not for further submissions, but to make a decision. Where do they reconvene? They reconvene in Italy. Who chairs the meeting of the principal allies of the Supreme Council? Who sits at this table where? In a villa. It's been upgraded. I'll show it to you in a moment. It's now a castle, Castillo now. It used to be a villa, but somebody recognized its importance. Here's the room where, you see at the U-shaped table, only four or five people sitting at the head. And while I realized the importance of that villa, I drove there with my wife and one of our daughters, and there was a British businessman who, it's now a luxury condo. And he was renting out his apartment, and we ended up in the apartment where the window is open, the door is open. And I ended up sitting and in the apartment, which is precisely the room where the meeting took place in April of 1920. So this is one of the defining moments of history, chaired by the government of Italy in this beautiful place. If you've not been there recently, it is a beautiful part of Italy. And while I was there, a lady came to me and gave me pictures, which were amazing pictures of the leaders in front of the steps, including the Prime Minister Nitti and the French Mitterrand and Lord George. And what do? They deliberate on what they'll do with the claims they heard in Paris. And they make a decision. These principal powers make the decision. And here's the resolution. To take the principles of the Balfour Declaration, which were not binding internationally, but they take the principle, insert it in a resolution, and that becomes the cornerstone of the rights of the Jewish people in respect to Palestine. Here's the leaders again, forgotten, misrepresented, neglected key historical moment. Sometimes people think that I may be exaggerating, even when I speak to Jewish audiences, the significance of this meeting in St. Remo. But then I quote the words of Weizmann, the great leader of the Zionist movement, who says that this is one of the most momentous political events in the whole history of their movement, and perhaps no exaggeration to say in the whole history of our people since the exile. Isn't that fascinating? Here's a great Jewish leader saying that this is one of the key moments in the history of the Jewish people, and most of the people I speak to on this earth have never heard of the conference in San Remo. Many Italians have not heard about the conference in San Remo. It was the turning point. And if you want to take the position that it wasn't that significant, be careful, because that is where they decided, the same Supreme Council, chaired by Italy, to say yes to the Arab submissions heard in Paris. Before then, very divided people, tribal, clans, nothing like a united front anywhere, and all of a sudden, they say yes, because of the support given during the war, they say yes to them. Here's the treaty that comes out of Saint Remo. This one is the mandate over Syria and Lebanon. I have no time to go into details, but note this key clause says that this is in favor of the inhabitants of that area, which are primarily Arab people. Here's the treaty that comes out of Saint Remo, this time relating to Iraq, then Mesopotamia. Here it is emphasized that it's for the benefit of those who inhabit the land. What about the mandate for Palestine? It's not for the inhabitants. The political rights are given to the Jewish people, provided that they honor and respect legally the civil rights and the religious rights of the inhabitants. One key thing from a legal point of view, this disposition clause of the treaty, which is a source of rights and obligations in international law and is still, I contend, relevant today as we try to make a final determination relating to Jerusalem and other parts of those areas. It refers to the preamble. The preamble is incorporated in the disposition clause. What's in the preamble? The key part is underlined in red. The principal powers say yes to the demand for recognition of the Jews as a people, to the demand for recognition of their historical rights, and yes to their demand for the right to reconstitute what they had. So if we're going to be fair, if we're going to act justly, we need to be mindful of what they had. And that's why the first 200 pages of my thesis deal with the history of Jerusalem and the place of Jews in Jerusalem and the place of Christians, the days of Jesus Christ in Jerusalem, and the significance of Jerusalem in Islam and for the Arab people. If I put these three key sections together, the contrast is obvious. Two for the inhabitants, and the third for the Jewish people. Here's the result of the decisions in Saint Remo reflected in the treaties I've just referred to. All that's green, and it's huge, former Ottoman territories, title to be given to the inhabitants under mandates, one with the French, Syria and Lebanon, one with the British, Mesopotamia. And all that's blue is supposed to be the area for the national home of the Jewish people. No time to go into the details, but Churchill in 1921 is facing a problem because the French got excited after San Remo. They moved in with some soldiers, kicked out Faisal out of Damascus. He's upset. Abdullah jumps, his brother jumps on a camel, gets a machine gun or whatever it was that he was using in those days, and there's going to be conflict again with the Arabs. Churchill says, meet me in Cairo. They meet in Cairo and says, here's what I'll do. I'll give to Faisal Iraq for his kingdom, and I'll give you, Abdullah, an area that we control as mandatories, Transjordan. Huge chunk of what was supposed to be for the national home of the Jewish people is taken away from them. However, Abdullah, as the new head of that government, commits in writing to make sure that everything that is left and already given to the Jewish people in Saint Remo and in the mandates, everything that's still in blue here, will be for the Jewish national home. Today, the Jewish people, the State of Israel, are trying to retain a component of what was West Palestine. What happened to all the commitments? By the way, Italy, one of the powers in San Remo, voted for the resolution. The Treaty of Sèvres comes in August, and it is signed by Italy, where it reaffirms these commitments to the Jewish people and to the Arabs, followed by the mandate for Palestine, which is approved by the Council of the League of Nations. And guess who's on the council? Guess who's one of the key nations on that? Italy. Followed by the Treaty of Lausanne, 1923. Italy again. The nations, including this one, have made commitment after commitment after commitment. And this is a defining moment of history from a justice point of view, because we are proposing to deny the rights that have already been given to the Jewish people.
Ancora due minuti, poi dobbiamo...
So sorry, 2 more minutes. I know this is a fascinating topic, but we really must invite you to wrap up in 2 minutes.
The resolution of the partition of 1947, my comment, General Assembly resolution, not binding. If the parties had agreed to that, it would have resulted in rights and obligations. Security Resolution 242 is something that's relevant in law. My conclusion is that nothing that has happened since the rights were given to the Jewish people and to the Arabs, St. Remo, the mandate subsequently, has been contradicted or nullified by anything that's happened after. And half my thesis pertains to the fact that these rights are still alive today. Thank you.
Ringraziamo Jacques Gauthier.
I'd like to thank Jacques Gauthier. It's very interesting, outstanding. Now I'd like to give the floor to Professor Luigi Compagna, famous historian, university lecturer, and he also teaches at Lewis University. And I'd like to ask for his viewpoint on this historical and legal account. And I'd like to thank Senator Compagna once again for being with us. Thank you. I would like to say that the very long itinerary which led from the Jewish question to the birth after World War II of the National Jewish State is a path in which an attempt is made to place the Jewish question in the area of international law. Herzl, Zionism, the conclusion of World War I, succeed to some extent in doing this, but not fully. One of the greatest tragedies of the generation which preceded ours is that the State of Israel was not established after World War I, but only after World War II. At the time of its establishment, however, the State of Israel had one very important reference, the United Nations. The United Nations succeeded in doing for the Jewish national state what Clemenceau, Lloyd George, Orlando, and Wilson had failed to do after World War I. After 1968, following the Six-Day War, I would say that for the State of Israel and the coalition of Friends of Israel in the world, the situation changes almost completely. If I were to single out the greatest enemy of the national Jewish state in the last 40 years, I would say, and I'm saying this with great sorrow, that the greatest enemy is the United Nations organization. It is, well, let's not applaud too much, because the national Jewish state, because of its nature, as a parliamentary democracy with the rule of law, not a theocratic state, is a state which sees its battle, sees its claims to the right to exist on the basis of law, of international law. And the issue which will be presented to the General Assembly in the month of September needs to see Israel and its friends placed along that line of saying yes to negotiations, no to an immediate recognition of the statehood of the PLO and Hamas organization. And because of this, the recent meeting between the Israeli Prime Minister and the Italian Prime Minister 2 weeks ago here in Rome was a very important occasion. We hope that in Europe this understanding between Israel and Italy will find support in countries which are traditionally friends of Israel. We hope that there will be the same willingness to support Israel which the Italian government has expressed to Netanyahu and the ministers accompanying him. If there's one positive signal, I think, which comes out of the news in Italy, I can say that whereas a month and a half ago there seemed to be some anxiety about Italy being on the side of the friends of Hamas and speaking against Israel, I think those anxieties have been allayed. And another thing is that there is in Italy there is in Italy a position on the part of the public opinion and on the part of the great on the most important Italian political forces and also among the associations between Italy and Israel. There's a very general support for the right of Israel to exist. And all Democrats in Italy of my generation have seen the state of Israel as a kind of a homeland for their own feelings of freedom and democracy. Even those who've come from afar, like our friend Magdi Alam, has had great friendship with Susanna Nierenstein, for example, the sister of Fiamma, and with Stefano Folli at the Corriere della Sera, and he has described his development as a journalist, as a person, as a citizen, and he's always seen the right of Israel to exist as a fundamental tenet, as the basis for the decisions he's taken in his life. The Arab Spring, Magdi will be speaking to you with greater knowledge and understanding of this, particularly as far as Egypt is concerned. Arab Spring is perhaps a formula which greatly oversimplifies things. It's something which is very convenient for journalists to use. I think things are more complicated and less spring-like. Between the year had begun in the period between Christmas and New Year very badly in Egypt, and the dearest friends of Magdi, the Copts, know all about that. And then substantially, despite a lot of rhetoric, what happened really was that there was a shifting of position on the part of the army. The army began to carry its rifle on a different shoulder, and this, if as we are told, this upheaval in Egyptian politics was based on a mediation. Also involved in mediation between Hamas and Abu Mazen, where there's nothing said about Gilad Halik. If we take that in consideration, we can say that this spring has been very wintry. Because I believe that Israel, and I recall the address of President Sharon to the United Nations in September, after which he was taken ill. Sharon, at the end of the dramatic summer, when there was the evacuation of Gaza, Sharon, who was facing an internal debate in Israel. The Minister Sharansky was actually opposing him, one of the highest democratic representatives. Sharansky was saying it is wrong to leave Gaza without being able to claim a success in terms of human rights, without being able to have some recognition of that kind. Sharon at the United Nations said, this is true, but this is a decision which is caused probably by despair, because for Israel, because of a number of considerations with regard to the population, things have become very difficult, and no prospects seem to exist. Not of a Palestinian state, but even of Palestinian statehood. Around Abu Mazen, there is a feudal world, a world of private police forces, whereas the history of Zionism, even before the Balfour Declaration, and even before the declaration which Herzl asked of the Ottoman state, in Israel, the settlements which existed were settlements which foreshadowed statehood. There were libraries, there were schools, there were unions, there were newspapers. From this point of view, we should avoid this rhetoric of two states, two peoples. There seems to be no sign of this development, and so from the idea within the United Nations of trying to accelerate the progress of having of presenting a fait accompli at the United Nations, which would give this agreement between Hamas and the PLO recognition, would be, to say the least, irresponsible. So from this point of view, I believe that the United Nations have already done enough against the State of Israel and against the friends of the State of Israel in the world. There are two things I'd like to remind you of: the 1975 declaration, with Zionism defined as a form of racism. Only the United States opposed this. The Europeans, either because of concerns over oil supplies or for other reasons, gave the impression that they were turning a blind eye. This was a period when a Secretary General of the United Nations was appearing on the horizon, called Waldheim, who seemed to be vulnerable to pressure and blackmail. And the second thing, which was very bad for free men in the world, happened last year, which was the Goldstone Report to the United Nations. A South African Jewish officer, I think, who only now in a recent declaration, which is obviously something which is a is honourable on his part, but a declaration where he recognised that he was mistaken in a number of his statements, and that he had damaged the reputation of the Israeli armed forces in an unjustified manner. So I believe that if any European countries on the 18th of September need to think about how to vote on the resolution on Hamas and PLO as a Palestinian state, they should really ask the United Nations beforehand to provide something which politically and diplomatically can re-establish the truth, and not, it's difficult to re-establish things when a wrong is done so deeply, but something which can re-establish the honor of a state which has been part of the United Nations and has shown no ideological hatred for any of the member states at any time.
I'd like to thank Senator Compagna for this extremely interesting address. He has also authored a very interesting book on Zionism and the connection with Mazzini. This is a very interesting text which shows that there is a link between Israel and Italy and Jewish thinkers. And I would like to now call on Reuven Rosen, who's here from Israel. Reuven Rosen is the representative of Friends of Israel Division. He's the director worldwide for Friends of Israel Division in Jerusalem. I'd like to invite him to the podium.
There's a
può ricordare.
Shalom. I'm sure I'm going to read, because I'm not a member of the parliament or anything, so I'll read what I have to say. But anyhow, honored members of parliament, honored friends, and of course, dear friends, my name is Reuven Rosen, and I'm in charge of the Friends of Israel Division worldwide of Keren HaYesod. Now, Keren HaYesod is the national fundraising organization for the State of Israel and was established in 1920 during the Zionist Conference in London. Three things were clear to the Zionist leaders then, as it is to the leaders of today. One, a Jewish homeland in the area of the Promised Land was needed. Later during the Second World War, this thesis was proved to be 100% right, I must say, and I'm sorry to say. You need to try to bring the Jews home to this homeland as soon as possible. This was also proved in the Second World War. And you need funds in order to do the job. Since then, millions of Jews have arrived home, but it's important to emphasize that this miracle of an ancient people returning to their homeland after having been dispersed for more than 2,000 years did not start in 1920. The urge of the people to return home, driven by an ancient codex of law, for whoever might wonder, I talk about the Bible, the Torah, also made some Jews, sporadically, although sometimes in quite serious numbers, mainly because of the persecutions, the religious persecution in the 13th to 19th century, try to come home during the 2,000 years diaspora, thus bringing the numbers of Jews in the Holy Land in 1880 up to the approximately 25,000 Jews in the Holy Land. That's it. In 1882, the first modern Aliyah started with the arrival of around 25,000 Jews, mainly from Eastern Europe. Since then, and until the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, there were five major waves of Aliyah, immigration. Aliyah is immigration, many of you know that. Including the clandestine Aliyah from 1933 till 1948, because of the strict limitations of Jewish immigration to Palestine, instigated by the British rulers. Now, all these waves altogether brought the number of Jews in Palestine, pre-State Israel, up to 600,000. There's no doubt that the arrival of the Jews before 1948, together with the witnesses of the Second World War, atrocities of the slaughter of 6 million Jews, enabled the world to recognize what had been recognized much earlier by the Zionist leaders we mentioned before, the need for a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Now, the establishment of a Jewish parliament called the Jewish Agency in 1929, during the Zionist Congress in Zurich, further enhanced the preparations for the Jewish state. The funds raised by Keren HaYesod were mainly spent on building the infrastructure of the Jewish entity in Palestine. In cooperation with the Jewish Agency and earlier bodies, just like the World Zionist Organization and the Palestine Executive and others, about almost 1,000 settlements, I know it's a bad word to say sometimes settlements, but these were settlements in the former Israel, which means in the Galilee and in the south of the Negev. About 1,000 settlements were built all over the country on land purchased by other organizations, like mentioned before, Keren Kayemet, the KKL, or the, well, that's the organization today planting a lot of trees in Israel. But then they purchased a lot of land in Israel on which the settlements built by money from the Keren HaYesod were built. Thus, slowly but surely, a geopolitical change happened, involving a beginning of a demographic revolution. Later, after the establishment of Israel in 1948, to be enhanced by the early statehood immigration from Arab countries, as well as the remnants of the Holocaust in Europe. Now, since 1948, more than 3 million Jews have come home from all over the world, openly as well as clandestinely. By the way, funded mostly by Jews around the world, but also during the last 30 years by non-Jews, amongst whom I must mention one of our co-hosts today, in cooperation with Kiana Esot, the Dutch-based Christian for Israel International. I would like to mention two operations of waves of immigration of Aliyah. The Aliyah from the former Soviet Union. A mass immigration from USSR to Israel was, for obvious reasons, not wanted by the Soviet regime. Between 1960 to 70, only 4,000 Jews left USSR for Israel, and between 70 to 80, around 200,000 left. Most of them to Israel, but also many outside Israel. But the main wave started in 1990. Probably because of the fact it was made possible to leave after so many years. Since then, more than 1 million FSU, former Soviet Union Jews, have arrived to Israel, and it's still going on. Every year, thousands of former Soviet Union Jews arrive to Israel, absorbed and starting an integration process. Already in the 50s, we started getting information about a dark-colored Jewish tribe living for thousands of years in Ethiopia. Since the Babylonian exile, really, 2,500 years back, very few started to arrive until 1983-85, when Prime Minister Begin ordered the Mossad to bring them home in masses. And there started the homecoming of what mostly is reconsidered to be one of the 10 lost tribes, namely the Dan tribe, to Zion, after thousands of years of waiting to get the signal. Till today, we have brought more than 80,000 home, and altogether, more than 130,000 of the Ethiopian diaspora are living in Israel today. We still have to bring in the last 8,000, happening as we speak today, and it will happen for the next 2-3 years. I'd like to tell you that Italy played a historic and important role in exploring this wonderful Jewish tribe and preparing them for the homecoming. Important fact, standing in this place and this building. Let me also share with you an experience I had a year ago during the visit of a Brazilian parliamentarian delegation to one of our absorption centers with 1,300 new immigrants from Ethiopia. The wife of the head of the delegation started crying after around 20 minutes. When asking her why she was crying, she answered me that Brazil is the country with the most black people in the world outside the African countries. Everyone talk about Israel and Israeli apartheid. And look what you're doing for thousands of African black people. It's important to emphasize some points in this whole process. The difficulty in integrating so many different nationalities in one little country of today, only 7 million inhabitants, was and is immense. I'd like to remind you that the mass immigration started with 600,000 that were supposed and succeeded in to absorb more than 3 million new immigrants in less than 70 years. Many of them coming from a life of mud huts with no running water and no electricity. It had and was a very strong impact of this young country with non-stop existential security threats. And still, we don't stop this very important job, because for 2,000 years our people have been struggling an almost impossible fight against anti-Semitism. We stood with the back to the wall, and today we stand facing the wall, the Wailing Wall, the Kotel, praying to our Lord independently in our own land, where every Jew can arrive and receive citizenship upon arrival. The immigration has not only been a burden, a welcome burden though, but also helped Israel with some important issues. During the 80s of the last century, the inflation in Israel was one of the highest in the world, reaching in some years a rate of 300 to 400% a year. It's a well-known fact, I've been told, that the very best way to fight inflation is by building infrastructure. The arrival of the hundreds of thousands of Jews from the FSU during the 90s made Israel build housing, towns, roads, all in all, to build infrastructure, and a lot. Imagine bringing 1 million immigrants to a country with only less than little less than 5 million inhabitants, which was the situation in 1990 in Israel. That would be like bringing 10 million new immigrants to Italy during the next 10 years. For that, you would need a lot of new infrastructure. And so it was. The FSU immigrants finally killed the high inflation rates in Israel and brought their numbers down to European rates. Now, the second point I'd like to emphasize to you, Israel, the only Jewish state in the world, is fighting a demographic battle to stay a state with a Jewish majority. The statistics of May 2011 show that the percentage of Jews in Israel went down with a rate of 0.2% during the last year. About 75% Jews in Israel today. Imagine how the figures would have been without the 20,000 new immigrants we brought home during 2010. And how would the numbers be without the active homebringing of the Jews since 1948? Without the ongoing immigration before, today, and tomorrow, there would not have been a Jewish state, and there will not be a Jewish state. And there would not have been a home for the Jews, an independent shelter when needed, and a place that every Jew can call his or her home, and where the word Jew is not a curse. Israel must stay strong and must stay the home of the Jewish people. Thank you very much, and shalom.
Rimanendo in tema di Israele, voglio.
So, remaining on the issue of Israel, I also want to thank the Director General of the El Al airline, who's present here. We'd like to thank him for being with us.
Voglio ringraziare.
And I also want to thank Cavini, Pier Cavini, who brought all these people. All the people who are responsible for travel, for transportation companies working for Israel. It's important to promote tourism in Israel. It's an important source of funds for the Israeli economy. Now, still considering Israel, from the vantage point of geopolitical scholars, I'd like to invite Dr. Mordechai Kedar. Very famous scholar on famous for his studies on Israel and the Arab world, Dr. Mordechai.
Yes, or there. Qualcuno può aiutare il professor Mordechai?
I have it fully charged, so I'm not sure. Four hours. I'll feel it.
Intanto che il professor Mordechai si.
So while waiting for Professor Mordechai to get everything ready, there's one thing I'd like to tell you, which is very important. Our goal in this seminar is to present a manifesto, where we will be collecting signatures to support Israel. As Italians, We want to stand by Israel. I'd like to give the floor to Professor Kedar now.
Honored members of the Parliament, Mr. Malan, Ms. Campagno, for someone who ruined his starts, but it will be there. Don't laugh. It will be there. Mr. Magdi Alam from the Middle East, Dr. Jacques Gauthier, Doctora Eda Fogalio, Thomas Sandel, and Andrew Tucker. Honored brothers and sisters, I must admit that during the last hour I changed my presentation 2 times. First of all, the legal basis for the struggle was very well and very thoroughly explained by Dr. Gauthier. I will not repeat it, no point. I think I'd rather address a very profound question, which is, what is the struggle in the Middle East all about? This, I think, will put a frame around many things, and I think after this presentation of 4 hours it needs 4 years, but after this presentation it might give some people the framework and things will be put in place. What is the struggle in the Middle East is all about? Some go back to San Remo, some go back to the Middle Ages. However, the problem which in the Middle East is today, started somewhere between 610 and 612. Not in Israel or Palestine, but in the Hijaz, in the Saudi, what today Saudi Arabia is. Muhammad, the Prophet of Islam, started to have revelation. And I do give him the benefit of the doubt that he had some kind of vision. However, when he started to preach to his brothers, sisters, cousins from the Quraysh tribe in Mecca, they accused him that all he is doing is recycling what's called in Arabic asatir al-awwalin, means the stories or the legends of the first ones, means Jews and Christians. Islam from the beginning, from its inception, was accused for being an illegitimate religion, irrelevant, because all what they heard is again the stories about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Jesus and Johannes and Solomon and David. all those figures whom they already knew from Jews and Christians. Since then, Islam is under the doubt of only being a recycling of the former religions. One of the ways that Muhammad had to face Judaism and Christianity is by questions and answers. Many places in the Quran it says yes alunaka, means they ask you, they challenge you, they accuse you, means the Prophet Muhammad, you should answer them such and such. Means the Quran actually is an echo for a debate between Muhammad, who represents a new religion which tries to become a legitimate one, and those who know that almost everything which he brings is actually asatir al-awwalin, means recycling of the legends of the former ones. Islam since that time tries to convince Muslims before others and others that Islam is a vivid, is a legitimate, is a valid religion. And until now, for 14 centuries, they are trying to convince themselves and others that Islam is valid. I think the religion which still is trying to convince people about its validity has some problem. One of the ways to challenge these questions was to undermine the validity of Judaism and Christianity. Means, if Islam succeeds to convince the others that Judaism and Christianity are not valid anymore, where else will people go if not to Islam? Means the strive to undermine Judaism and Christianity is built in the idea, in the message of Islam. This idea came very clear when it came to the question of Jerusalem. What do I mean by this? Jerusalem, as people might know, especially those who read the sources, Jerusalem is not mentioned in the Quran, not even once. Thank you. Jerusalem is not mentioned in the Quran even one time. However, how can you convince Jews and Christians to embrace Islam when Islam doesn't recognize the validity of Jerusalem? This is a kind of problem. In his days, in Muhammad's days, there was a village near, between Mecca and Taif, well-known city until today, well-known city in Saudi Arabia. And between Mecca and Taif, there was a village named Jirana. I won't test you later about this. He used to go to visit his people in Taif, and this is according to Islamic sources. Muhammad used to go to visit his followers in Taif. But at night, he would spend the night in this village, Al-Jirana, because he couldn't be outside during the night, because he will be devoured either by four-legged animals or two-legged animals. This is the desert. So he would pray in the morning in one of two mosques which were built in this village, near this village. One was closer to the village, named Al-Masjid Al-Adna, the closer mosque. The other one was further, was called Al-Masjid Al-Aqsa, the further mosque. This was in his days, not in Jerusalem. However, 50 years after Muhammad passed away, there was a rebellion in Islam, and a guy named Abdullah ibn Zubayr closed the ways to pilgrimage, to Hajj, to Mecca. And people who lived in Damascus, especially under the Umayyad dynasty, were not allowed to come to Mecca to pilgrimage. So they wanted to have an alternative place rather than Mecca. But they didn't have any holy place for Islam in that part of the Middle East, in the northern part, in Syria. So the Caliph Yazid bin Muawiyah decided, okay, Jerusalem was holy for Jews. Jerusalem was holy for Christians. Let it be also holy for Muslims. But they told him, hey, but Jerusalem is not mentioned in the Quran. So he says, no problem. Let's say that the Al-Aqsa is in Jerusalem. And since Al-Aqsa is mentioned in the Quran, let's say that the night journey of Muhammad, which was to Jirana, let's say that it was to Jerusalem. Nobody now, in the year of 682, like 50 years after Muhammad passed away, nobody remembers where the real Al-Aqsa was. Nobody knows where real Al-Aqsa was 50 years earlier. So let's convince the people to come to pilgrimage to Jerusalem rather than coming to Mecca. This is when he built the Dome of the Rock on a church
It is. It's okay.
See, it works. Rome is the city of miracles. This is why he built the Dome of the Rock in the middle of the court with a golden dome. So And he built it on a church. Why? One of the ways to prove that Christianity and Judaism lost their validity was by saying, and this is a verse in the Quran, "Inna dina inda Allah al-Islam," means that religion with Allah's is only Islam. Means Allah does not recognize any other religion but Islam. Means Judaism and Christianity have no validity anymore. So why Christians need churches? Let the church turn to be a mosque or a dome for Muslims. This is what was made in the center of the Temple Mount. The same thing was in many, many other cities which were occupied by Muslims. In Damascus, the Umayyad Mosque is built on a church. In Istanbul, the Hagia Sophia is built on a church. In Ramla, in Israel. In Spain, how many churches were turned into mosques? Because, anyway, Christianity, along with Judaism, lost its value. So what do they need churches for? Not only churches were confiscated. Not only churches were confiscated and turned into Islamic mosques or other institutions, also personalities. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Jesus and Johannes all are Muslim prophets retroactively. Why? Because if Judaism and Christianity lost their value, everyone who ever believed in one single God evidently was a Muslim. How else? What else could he be? So this is how Islam re-engineers the theology and history to declare that everyone, Jew or Christian, who was before Islam came to the world in the 7th century, was actually a Muslim. And Abraham, of course, was the first Muslim in the world. And King Solomon built a mosque in Jerusalem, as we all know. So this is the way how Islam, in order to establish its own validity, undermines the validity of the Christianity and Judaism, because in their mind, Islam did not come to the world to live side by side with Judaism and Christianity. It rather came to the world to replace them and to nullify whatever Judaism and Christianity mean. However, during the last century, a big disaster happened. It started with 1948, when Jews were given, or if you want, 1920, and the whole process until 1947, the decision of the partition, the Jews were given parts of Palestine to return to their homeland. In the Islamic religious point of view, this is a very big problem, because Jews were expelled by Allah, they were sent away to no return. So how come the world, who didn't even own this place, because this is an Islamic holy endowment waqf land, Palestine was declared as holy land to Islam by Umar ibn Khattab, the second caliph, who occupied Palestine in 638. He declared this is a holy endowment country for Islam. And anyway, wherever a Muslim puts his foot becomes an Islamic country. Spain, for example, or Sicily, for example, all those places where Muslims were formerly should return to be Islam because they are Islamic lands. So all of a sudden, those infidel states which toppled the Islamic Ottoman Empire take part and give it to the Jews. Since when these League of Nations had anything to do with Palestine? It doesn't belong to them. How can they give it to the Jews? So the whole idea of partition was rejected because it contradicts the Islamic way of looking at the land of Palestine. The country was, the state was established in 1948, and the world recognized it. This was an accident. Second accident happened 19 years later, 1967. When Israel occupies Jerusalem. And this is a very dangerous development. Why? Now those Jews regained their hold to Jerusalem. What will they do the next step? They will build the temple again. And this way Judaism will come back to life. And maybe Jesus Christ, who will come back from the dead, he will have again where to preach and where to function. So Judaism and Christianity will come back to life what will be with Islam. Because Islam in its own view came to the world to replace Judaism and Christianity. So the idea that the Jews, with the mercy of the Christians, with the decision of the Christians, come back to the country, come back to their city, will build again the temple, this way Judaism and Christianity will be valid again, will come back to life. What will be the future of Islam? This will pose a big question mark on the validity of Islam, which came to the world to replace both Judaism and Christianity. This is why, in their view, the question of Jerusalem, the question of Palestine, is not a question of territory. It's a question of theology before everything else. Of course, it has translation to territorial terms, to legal terms, to historical terms, to national terms, to all kinds of terms. But the basis of the whole thing is religion, or religious philosophy, or the way Islam views itself as a religion which came to the world to replace the former religions. How do I know this? This is what Palestinians go around in demonstrations. Something which you can buy wherever you like. It has two sides. By the way, this is issued by the PLO, not by Hamas. One side says Al-Quds Lana, means Jerusalem is ours. The other side shows Palestine. The entire country, from the sea to the Jordan River. I bought it in East Jerusalem from a dealer. So I asked him, so where is Israel? So he says, well, maybe in the sea, in the Mediterranean. Means for their point of view, we can join the fish. They might accept us. Not them, Muslims. And this for me is actually the whole story of what is the struggle over Jerusalem. It's not a struggle about Israel. It's not a struggle about the land even. It's the struggle about the doubts which Muslims still have about their own religion, whether this religion is real or this is only a replica of the former religions. After all, if you read the Quran, and I highly recommend to read the Quran, 80% of the Quran is Jewish stuff, from the Torah, from the Bible, from the legends of the Jewish legends, from the Midrashim, what we say. 10% are sediments of Christianity. Another 10% are remains of pagan religions, which were in the Arab Peninsula until the 7th century, and the proof is the Kaaba. You know, the stone which they surround in Mecca was an idol for centuries before Islam came to the world. But since this idol, the Kaaba, was so engraved into the culture of those tribes, Muhammad, instead of rejecting it and destroying it, he Islamized it. There is, you can say in English, if you cannot beat them, Islamize them. So this is, thank you. This is actually what was with the Kaaba. And I would spare you the descriptions of what was done in the Kaaba as a kind of worship. You can read it by yourself. So this is actually what the struggle is about. This is actually what the struggle is about. Is the struggle about Islam, the struggle of Islam to justify itself in the eyes of its own adherents before it is something about else, by nullifying, by delegitimizing, and by pulling the rug from the other religion's validity. This is, in a nutshell, what the struggle over Jerusalem and the land of Israel is. But the question now is to the world. Thank you very much. So the question now to the world, to Christendom, to the Jewish people, do we all surrender? Do we all agree with this? Do we cover it with other issues like territory or national issues? Or do we address the core problem? How can we do it? First of all, the call should come out from every city in the world to those who believe that their validity is built on nullifying the other's validity, is first of all to check their own values, to check their own scriptures, to check their own beliefs. The world should tell them, deal with your problems. Leave the others alone. Your problems are domestic problems of Islam. Leave Judaism, leave Christianity alone. This is not your business. Holy places of Judaism and Christianity should remain forever holy places for Judaism and Christianity. The world, the civilized world, should tell them to build their validity on their own sources and not to undermine others' holy views, places, and personalities. It's not easy, because for 14 centuries, Islam is established on nullifying others. However, there is a hope, because there is a kind of Islam, the Sufi Islam, which tolerates the others, which accepts the others, which takes the others as a given and tries to live with the world as it is. Unfortunately, terrorists, jihadists do not share this view, and in their view, their task in the world is to have the word of Allah, the Supreme One, and the word of the others, the one in beneath. And this is what the struggle is for, and this is what they do. The world has to understand the origin of those issues. However, the world today, the Western world today, I would say, tends to leave religion aside from anything else. Laïcité is the name under which, or the concept under which everything which is connected to religion is pushed aside, it remains only in the private sphere. Religion is left alone. Nobody really cares about religion. Just look about values of family, which are in the real deterioration, especially in Europe, but not only, where religion is marginalized, when religion is ignored, when religion stops to be anything connected to real life. This is what Western civilization is today. But when it has to face a culture which is driven by religion, which is motivated by religion, which is inflamed by religion, when religion actually is the source of their motivation, Western civilization today has no power, because it lost the religious ambition and the religious motivation to use its own values as some kind of immunity to face another culture which is motivated by religion. We, and unfortunately too many Jews and too many Christians today, would tolerate everything, would accept anything, as long as it can be viewed as religion. Who cares about religion today? Yes, this is where we, Jews and Christians, will be defeated if we leave religion and if we do not use our values as some kind of a common denominator which will unite us all in face of a culture which uses religion as a sword to deal with us all. However, how much time do I have?
2 minutes.
Okay. Some things can be used. Even things which were made by Islam. Formerly we saw by Edda, we saw the Mufti, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was part of the Muslim Brotherhood, who took part in extermination of the Jews from Hungary in 1944. However, we should thank him for something. In 1925, and again in 1927, and 9, and 30, and maybe 35 as well, he kept publishing a booklet about Jerusalem in English in order to drag tourists from Britain to Jerusalem. I would show you a few sentences from this booklet, because this booklet actually shows that what he really did. A brief guide to Al-Haram al-Sharif, Jerusalem. A short guide, published by the Supreme Muslim Council, 1925. And it has some other versions. I have one of the originals of 130 in my bag, but this is the same thing. What does he say in this? He brings in pictures, everything. However, he gives in the third page, right in the beginning, a historical sketch about the Haram. What does it say in this historical sketch? Here. Its sanctity dates from the earliest, perhaps from prehistoric times. He talks about the Haram al-Sharif, the Temple Mount. Its identity with the site of Solomon's Temple is beyond dispute. Its identity with the site of Solomon's Temple is beyond dispute. This, too, is the spot, according to the universal belief, on which David built there an altar unto the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. This is a verse from Samuel, the book of Samuel. And this was written in 1925 and republished a few years later again. He did this in order to bring tourists to Jerusalem. After all, tourists bring good money, as Italy knows very well. And he wanted also to have part of this tourist movement into Palestine as well. But when you listen to them today, the speakers of the radical Islam, they would say without even blinking that Jerusalem never was anything connected to Judaism, the temple was in other places in the world, and there is no evidence that ever there was anything connected to Judaism in Jerusalem. Where did Jesus Christ preach if not in Jerusalem? But today, they couldn't care less about those facts of history, because they contradict the view of establishing Islam on the ruins of Judaism and Christianity. So today, when they see this, I already heard, they said this is a Zionist forgery, which was made later, as if it was published. I have one of the original booklets with me. Everybody can check it, whether it's a forgery or not. The paper is the paper from the 20th. Not from now. So this is actually the discourse which changes according to the political changes in the Middle East. Today Israel is there, they cannot defeat it, so they try to undermine the legitimacy of the state of Israel in the United Nations and wherever, And what is going to be maybe in September is part of the delegitimization of Israel in order to topple Israel totally and to gain the land of Palestine, only to remove the danger that Jews will stick to Israel, to the land of Israel, and God for Allah forbid, they will rebuild the temple and undermine Islam totally. So this is the whole, this is the framework of what goes on to be in September. It's from Islamic point of view, more than any Palestinian national, by the way, Palestinian, not, there is not even one book or paper or newspaper in the world which mentions the Palestinian people before 1920 CE. Because Palestine was only a small district in the Middle East, just like Jordan, which nobody mentioned before 1922, or Syria or Lebanon. Everything was part of the Sham, and everyone was a Shami. So, this whole modern creations made by the world, made by the United, by the League of Nations, later by the United Nations, which they, Muslims, do not recognize. To sum, the struggle basically is a religious struggle between Islam on one side and Judaism and Christianity on the other side. Everything else is a derivative of this basis or basic struggle of Islam to establish itself on the ruins of Judaism and Christianity. The world today has to decide whether the world surrenders, no, whether the world, first of all, does not understand the nature of the struggle. Because if I hear today that 130 countries, states, are ready to agree on September to the establishing of the Palestinian state, means representatives of 130 states in the world do not understand the core problem of the struggle in the Middle East. They were deceived either by money or by oil or by others. Otherwise, they wouldn't agree to this. Secondly, those who might agree are those who pushed aside religion from their own life so they don't care about others who use religion as a Trojan horse in order to enter the world, to the civilized world, and to Islamize it, as some already noticed. The question is, will the world with the Christendom and Jewish world will stand aside and let this happen, or will try to do something in order to stop this march of Islam to take the world, starting with Jerusalem, starting with Israel, only because there are some in the world who think that if Israel will be given to Islam, Islam will let everybody else alone and will take Israel, and that's it. I think this is a big mistake, because after they will succeed in Jerusalem and Israel, the next stop will be Sicily, the next stop will be Spain, those lands which were Islamic until the Middle Ages, and the rest of the world will come later. There is a verse in the Quran which says, "Inna Allah ma'a sabirin," means Allah is with those who have patience, and they have a lot of patience. Thank you very much.
Ringraziamo il professore Kedar Mordecai.
We would really like to express our appreciation to Professor Mordecai Kedar, and would also like to thank Marcello Pera, who is with us. It is an honor for us to receive you, to have you here. Senator, would you like to speak? Not yet, so we will give the floor to Magdi Alam Cristiano, He is a member of the European Parliament, of Egyptian Arab origin. He's very well known in Italy. Over to you. Thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to thank you for your patience, because we've been here for the past 3 hours or so, and the only thing that we can be encouraged by is the fact that we all feel the same about these things, and I'm happy to say that in the presence of so many politically incorrect people, we really must join ranks and feel comforted by the presence of so many who see things as we do, because the time has come for us to make important choices. And I would like to focus on the subject at hand, Israel, Palestine, and the Arab Spring. And I will start off by expressing the concerns surrounding the possibility that the UN may decide in favor of a unilateral recognition of the state of Palestine. For many years, I have dealt with the subject of the Middle East, and I would like to reassure you, this is not something we should be too concerned about, because in fact it is almost a thing of the past. In Algiers on the 15th of November in 1988, the PLO Parliament, the National Palestinian Council, proclaimed the establishment of an independent Palestinian state out of 192 member countries of the UN. Out of 102 member countries, 130 recognized the Palestinian state as an independent state. So the majority of countries formally recognized the Palestinian state as an independent state. This happened 23 years ago, and we forgot about that since. So I think that if the UN General Assembly were to do something along those lines, I don't think we ought to be too worried, because there's a difference between virtual reality and a real reality, and the latter always prevails. And among the countries which approved this proclamation, we include all of the Islam Arab countries, all of the communist bloc countries, Soviet Union, and satellite countries. But there are also a number of European countries, including Malta, Austria, Norway, Italy, immediately thereafter. Recognized the presence of the PLO and attributed to the PLO a diplomatic status as a Palestinian delegation. So the name of Palestine officially appeared in the Italian political and diplomatic scene. And I don't want to go back on this, but allow me to say that there was deceit, because this name does not actually correspond to a people, to a state, which in fact, de facto, has never existed. Now, I'm happy to talk about a topic that we haven't addressed as yet. What we're seeing along the southern rim of the Mediterranean has emphatically been described as the Arab Spring. What we're seeing, in fact, is a strategy that originates in 2006, and to be very precise, January 2006, when the then US President George W. Bush and the then British Prime Minister Tony Blair, exercising firm pressure on the Israeli government and on the Egyptian government, requested that Islamic fundamentalists be involved in the electoral process, irrespective of their democratic status. And they achieved this. Their belief was that participating in an electoral process would have somehow rendered them democratic. And that is how, in the Palestinian territories, Hamas won the elections and de facto appointed its prime minister. And in Egypt, pursuant to an agreement that had preceded the elections between the then Egyptian President Mubarak and the Muslim Brotherhood, it was established that the Muslim Brotherhood would have run for elections only in some of the electoral districts, and the total number of MPs from the Muslim Brotherhood was to be limited to 90, and 88 Muslim Brotherhood MPs were elected in the Egyptian parliament as a consequence. Such a process is basically driven by the West's vital urge to defeat the so-called jihadist Islamic terrorist movement, which is inspired by the Islamic Holy War, the Jihad, and that pursues the objective of Islamizing the world through violence, killing the enemies of Islam. After 9/11, for the USA, this became the top priority on the nation's agenda, defeating Islamic terrorism, the cutthroat variety of terrorism, i.e., those whose objective is to be attained through the physical elimination of the enemy, whoever that enemy may be. And it is significant that the terrorists are Islamic, but most of the victims are Muslims, because the objective is that of conquering power at any price. And the West, in general, and the United States, Great Britain today, France, agreed that it was advisable to invest in that form of respectable-looking, suit-wearing fundamentalism that is fluent in their tongue and claims its availability to negotiate. And that is seen as being juxtaposed to the radical jihadist fundamentalist movement. Both, however, share the same aim, that of Islamizing the world. So the West decided to invest considerable amounts of money so that the Muslim Brotherhood and other players may be considered as legitimate players in the process of democratization, in the electoral process. And once again, this is a gross mistake, because elections are seen as the equivalent, the expression of democracy. But Europe, at least, should know that that is not the case. Let's not forget that both Hitler and Mussolini were elected through free elections. But history hasn't taught us any lessons, apparently. Today, we observe millions of people take to the streets, demonstrating, denouncing injustice, poverty, demanding change, change of regimes. Europe, the West, is easy to respond enthusiastically. Our video cameras, our crews show the faces of young people who speak in French and English, wear jeans, T-shirts, trainers, and say they use the internet to communicate to the rest of the world, and we automatically, acritically, term these democratic revolutionaries who demonstrate for freedom and democracy. But in fact, we discover that those who benefit from these protests are the regimes in power and the fundamentalists who have entered into an agreement playing different parts to consolidate their position. On the one hand, the army continues to manage security and defense matters and foreign policy, and fundamentalists, Islamic fundamentalists, are free to operate domestically. And that is exactly what they want. Now, that which differentiates the different Muslim Brotherhood affiliated groups is the fact that they claim that they are grassroots movements, and therefore they are prepared to give us the privilege of surviving physically, of not being killed, provided that we give them more mosques, we give them more Quranic schools, we give them more Islamic financial aid organizations and more Islamic courts. Hence, creating an Islamic state within the existing state based on rule of law. And the situation is common to a number of other regions of the world, including Europe. And we're so fearful, we're so subjected by a civilization that is based on materialism and consumerism, that we're prepared to accept this barter. In other words, you will allow us to survive physically, and in exchange for that, we will give you full legitimacy, irrespective of the contents of the Quran or of what the Prophet Muhammad said or did. All religions, all cultures, all values are considered as being equal, and we therefore renounce reason. We limit ourselves to loving others, our neighbors, and hating ourselves. And we think that this is to our advantage, because in the short term, this will mean avoiding the risk of suicide bombers blowing themselves up in a supermarket, a square, or a bar. Now, obviously, Israel is rightly concerned in the face of this. And we often forget that Israel is the only state in the world in which the majority of Islamic countries, towards which, sorry, the majority of Islamic countries does not recognize its right to exist. And Israel's right to exist as a state of the Jewish people is not recognized. And this is not a minor detail. When we talk about Israel today, in Europe, we forget an important point. We continue to discuss Israel as if it were an issue like any other, as if it were a question like any other in international politics. And we forget that countries have not recognized the right of Israel to exist as the state of the Jewish people. And some Islamic states have publicly stated that they would like to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. And this is done first and foremost by the Iranian Nazli Islamic regime, which has openly said that Israel must disappear off the face of the earth. And we hear this one day and forget about it the next, as if this were a matter of minor importance. And this is why, when today we hear that the United Nations are considering a unilateral recognition of an independent Palestinian state, the bitterness, the frustration, and disappointment stems from the fact that whereas we do not deny anyone's right to exist, and even though we hope that one day Palestinians may live serenely, autonomously, with an adequate development opportunity so that the Palestinian people may lead a dignified life. We realize, however, that the international community, unfortunately, for the most part, does not give a damn about the survival of the state of Israel. It is a non-issue, and that is the truth of the matter. So the focus is on the right of Palestinians to a Palestinian state, but that's not the point. Today, most Israelis are in favor of the two-state, two-people solution. Most Israelis want peaceful coexistence between the state of Israel and a Palestinian state on the basis of recognition of the right to security of the state of Israel as the state of the Jewish people. So that is not the problem. The real problem is that on the opposite front, there is denial of the right of Israel to exist as the state of the Jewish people. And there continues to be a tactical approach that Quranically is that of a truce, the Hudna, when in 628 Muhammad, realizing that he was unable to defeat his Meccan enemies, decided to establish a truce with his enemies and promising that he would not enter the Mecca for the next 10 years. But the subsequent year, given that he had the necessary forces, he violated the truce and he occupied the Mecca. So the concept of Hudna, which is proposed repeatedly by Hamas, is rooted in this situation, truce being the opposite of peace. A truce is entered into, as Muhammad did, with an enemy that we can't defeat, only with the purpose of eliminating the enemy physically, of killing the enemy when given the first chance. I'm worried in the face of what is happening in the southern Mediterranean. And I'm worried particularly because the West is an accomplice in this. Obama is an accomplice in what is happening in the southern Mediterranean. We must not hide this fact. We must be aware of this, because otherwise we would be unable to distinguish our friends from our enemies. Our enemy is denying the right of Israel to exist as a state of the Jewish people. And we have to differentiate on this basis. We cannot become allies with those who deny the right of Israel to exist. And I'm worried because the West claims that it wishes to bring democracy to Libya by bombing that country and by pursuing an initiative promoted by Nicolas Sarkozy for some electoral agenda of his. And this discredits us and makes us less credible, and I think it jeopardizes the very notion of democracy. And this will ultimately strengthen Islamic radicalism. You know, we talk about the Libyan opposition movement, but we really don't know who these opponents are. And I fear that once the myth of the Arab Spring is dispelled, we will discover that we will have removed autocrats, heads of state and government, who were authoritarian, only to replace them with Islamic dictatorships. Because Islamics know no truce. That is something that is alien to them. They have entered into a truce with the military, with a sharing of roles, but their real objective is that of taking total control. There's no concept of peace in Islam, Quranically. And therefore, I would like to invite you all, and I hope we'll may be many, I invite you all to sign this statement in order to denounce the UN initiative, which aims to arrive at a unilateral recognition of the state of Palestine, not because we're against the recognition of rights, not because we are against the fact that Palestinians should be given the right to live autonomously. That we want this, but we know that such a unilateral recognition would bolster Islamic fundamentalism against Israel, and such a recognition would exacerbate the prejudice against Israel that exists in Europe as well. So I'm happy to sign this statement, and I would like to invite you all to do the same. Thank you.
Grazie. Grazie, onorevole. Grazie. Prima di procedere alla lettura del manifesto, dove noi vi chiederemo di sottoporre la vostra firma, vorrei passare la parola al presidente Marcello Pera.
Sì, è un po' stretto di là.
Come stai?
It is. Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you. I would like to thank you, all of you, for being here. And I would like to congratulate with Thomas Sandel and Lucio Malan for organizing this meeting. They did invite me also to give a presentation. Unfortunately, I didn't have a time, so I'm not going to give a presentation, but just a couple of remarks. But I really congratulate you. There are two points I would like to raise with you. One is political, and the political has to do with the manifesto, the declaration we are going to sign today. Because if the point is to try to avoid a unilateral United Nations declaration for the independence of the Palestinian state, I do agree with you. I think that, although I believe that, as Magdi Cristiano Magdi was saying, is that declaration might be harmless, it may become also harmful, because nobody knows, once you have the right to official recognition of being a state, you can try to exercise that right to being a state, even with violence and so on and so forth. So those who want really a peace, truce between the Palestinians and the Israelis should not, in my view, sign a declaration which may take things more and more difficult. But that's not what. So from that point of view, I completely agree with you. But the other point I would like to make is a cultural point. I do also, because I'm impressed by the name of the association, the Christians for Israel. I am a member of another association, International Association, the Foundation of Friends of Israel. You may know something of it. It's presided over by former Prime Minister José María Aznar and includes a lot of important people, previous heads of states, prime minister, and so on and so forth, and which is focused mainly on the cultural point. Of course, we support Israel, the existence of Israel, and so on. But we are stressing one point, which I would like to say, which is this: there is right at the beginning of the statute of that foundation, Friends of Israel, there is a sentence which is, in my view, is very telling. It says, allow me to quote just a couple of lines, "Western democracy will not prevail unless we accept the Judeo-Christian cultural and moral values that first gave rise to our institutions and the values that inspired them." This is not an historical claim. This is a conceptual claim. It means to establish a link between the Judeo-Christian tradition and the open, liberal, democratic Western society. It's a link, a conceptual link. Why? That's the point I would like to stress, and that's why I really like the idea of Christians for Israel, because we may have a lot of agreement and disagreement with the Israeli government and Israeli administration. That's a democracy, so administration go back and forth, they change, like in any other democratic or liberal democratic country. That's not the problem. Sometimes we agree with them, sometimes we don't agree. We are divided between left and right, moderate, radical, whatever. That's fine. But there is one point which is important. That is a democracy. Everybody seems now to agree what this fact. That's the only liberal democratic regime in the Middle East area. Why? What is a Christian, a liberal, and democratic society and regime? Well, now we know in the West, in Europe, or we should know, that liberal democracy and the open society are based on one main important fundamental idea. That is the idea of the human rights. We say we belong to to a liberal democratic society just because we are endowed by fundamental human rights. So our states are there in order to respect, to protect, not to create, to respect and protect the human rights. That also means that the fundamental human rights are prior to and independent from the state. That's the cultural fundamental human rights. The question is, where that culture, that idea of fundamental human rights, people endowed with fundamental rights, where does that idea come from? Historically speaking, it comes from the culture, liberal culture in Europe, from John Locke, Immanuel Kant, a lot of other people, 17th, 18th century. Historically speaking, but culturally speaking, philosophically speaking, that idea, look at the Declaration of Independence of the United States, that idea stems from another idea that we are creatures. So we have been created in the likeness and image of God. That's the idea. That's why we have a dignity. That's why we are persons. That's why we have to be respected. That's why we have the fundamental right of the dignity and the respect. That idea is exactly linked to that religion, Judaism and Christianity. Oh, of course, there is history in the middle. We know everything about the relationship between Christianity and Judaism and so on and so forth. We know everything about anti-Semitism. We do apologize. Each of us is guilty of something. But the idea is there. The idea was there even before us, even before the constitution of Israel. So if we think of that idea, then we can understand why there is a link between the Judeo-Christianity and the social and the liberal democracy. And we can also understand that why Christians should side with Israel in their fight. It's not just a question of political question, the right to existence. It's not a question of right to safety. No, that is something more. Israel is part of the West, is part of Europe, just because of that idea. This is the point which is very interesting to me. If European leaders, if European politicians, if European intellectuals, instead of focusing on this or that aspect of the Israel administration, of the historical events and so on, start thinking seriously about this foundation of of Israeli state and our own liberal state, then we establish an immediate link and a friendship between Israel and Europe and the West. That's my point. It's not a question of feeling guilty of our yesterday anti-Semitism. I feel guilty, but that's not the point which decides me or induces me to support Israel. Because after all, that's my father's or my grandparents' fault, not my fault. So what I'm saying has not much to do with feeling guilty of previous anti-Semitism, rather than feeling proud of the relationship, the cultural, religious, spiritual relationship between Christianity and Judaism. If we stress this point, there will never be another never again. Oh, I've participated many, many times to the ceremonies every year, every January, to all these typical ceremonies in the West, in Europe, where people beat their breasts and say, oh, we feel guilty, never again, never again. If you really want a never again end of this story, then you have to understand why never again. So I'm trying to provide you some cultural, intellectual, if you want, philosophical reasons why there is a link, a strict, important link between these two cultures. That's why Israel is a democracy. Oh, there's another question. But if liberal democracy is connected with Judeo-Christianity, does that mean, that's an intriguing question, and we shouldn't be afraid of raising it, does that mean that Muslim countries, Arab countries cannot have a democracy? I'm not implying that. I don't know of any historical evidence against. I don't know of any religious reason against that. That's a possible outcome. What I can say is that up to now, we cannot speak of any Islamic democracy. That's evidence. That's historical. If you don't want to be blind to evidence, we have to admit that. If liberal democracy is linked with Judeo-Christianity, does that mean that we, as a Judeo-Christian, should fight, declare war to Islamic Arab countries? No. That does not imply. Should we try to export our democracy with guns to their countries? That's not an implication. That's not my point. That means that we have to induce them, to force them, to show them that there is another road, there is another alternative, that is democracy. And once you have a democracy, then you have to respect human rights and so on and so forth. And then you have, at least, more peaceful relationship between states. That seems to me a very clear point, unfortunately. And any time I try to make this point in the public, I see people agreeing with me. What is more difficult, seems to me more difficult, is to let European leaders, including the present-day American leaders, be convinced That is the road we have to take if you want to solve that problem. Any other political solution, any other attempt, like unilateral declarations and so forth, will not solve the problem, because it will not solve radically the problem. And the radical problem is there. So I do really applaud you. I really very proud of these associations. And I do really believe that Christians have to be, have to side and to be for Israel. And the reasons are not mainly typically political. Reasons are cultural, intellectual, philosophical. These are much more important and deeper than the others. Thank you.
Grazie, Presidente.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Prima di passare la parola al senatore.
Before calling on Senator Malan for conclusions, I would like to invite Andrew Tucker, Christians for Israel International, Christians for Italy, was established in the course of this year. I would like to therefore invite Andrew Tucker to join us. He's going to read the manifesto and explain why Christians for Israel International has undertaken to promote this. So we will then open this to your support. We will invite you to sign the document, and we will then invite Senator Malan to conclude the proceedings.
Put the green one. Okay, first of all, thank you very much, Edda. Thank you all of you for being so patient. We're all tired, and we're going to move now into the very last moment of the conference, into the formal part where we sign the manifest, all of which all of you have a copy of that document in English and in Italian. I want to thank all of the speakers on behalf of Christians for Israel and the European Coalition for Israel for spending the whole afternoon taking your time to be with us, to share with us. I think this is a very fundamentally important event that we have witnessed here in Rome. I want to just make one brief remark, and that relates to the relationship, speaking to you as Italian Christians. We need to understand as Gentiles what Paul, the Apostle Paul, said to the church in Rome in the 11th chapter of the Epistle to the Romans, that we are grafted into the olive tree of which Israel is the natural branch. Our identity as Christians, and certainly as European Christians, depends on Israel and the future of the Jewish people. Our future depends on their future. Yeah? So we do not have a future unless the Jewish people and Israel has a future. And I don't mean that in a political sense, I mean that in a deeply spiritual sense and a very practical sense. That's why it's important that we're doing what we do today, because we're standing up for who we are. We are making an affirmation of our own identity as Gentiles grafted into God's purposes with Israel. God has not left Israel. He has not abandoned his people. And he is bringing them home. That's why I'd like to make a presentation to the speakers of a special book we have published with the help, and I'd like to invite the publisher, Pietro Evangelista from Destiny Image Europe in Pescara. This is a book about Judea and Samaria. This is not a book about the West Bank. This is not a book about the occupied territories. This is a book about Judea and Samaria, including Jerusalem. This belongs to the Jewish people. And if you read this book, you will see how the Jewish people are resettling their land. God is planting them again in their land. And so on behalf of Christians for Israel and the European Coalition for Israel, I'd like to invite the speakers to come and receive a copy of the book. Dr. Jacques Gauthier, thank you very much. Senatore Campagna. Senatore Malan. Mr. Matti Alam Cristiano. Jacques Gauthier reminded us of a Latin, you can't give what you don't have. Because we don't have enough copy of the books, I just took the copy from Senator Malan because I want to give it to former President Perra. Thank you. And Mr. Mordecai Kedar, we're going to give you a copy of the book Why Israel by Reverend Willem Glashauer. And finally, Reuven Rosen. Good. I give the floor to Senator Malan.
Again, I said at the beginning that there would be many interesting speeches, many interesting contributions to the discussion, and they were more than interesting. They were really digging deep in our soul. And I think we have learned many things, we have felt many things together. And I think that it was a very good afternoon. We spent very well these 3 hours. In fact, we were here. We couldn't move. It was long, but we didn't feel it long. We felt it. So capturing every one of us, that I think it was a very good way to spend this Thursday afternoon. And just to finish, I would like to say that as it has been said now, and as a summary I try to make of what we said in this afternoon, is that we have to defend Israel unless we want to give up liberty. We have to defend Israel unless we want to give up democracy. We have to defend Israel unless we want to give up our roots as Christians, our roots as Jews, our roots as Europeans living in democratic and free countries. We have to defend Israel unless we want to give up truth. And I think that every human relationship is based on truth. This is why it is so vital for us to make the case of Israel against all those who try to persuade us that is just like any other case of international policy, that this is just a dispute where there everything can be an opinion. It's not such a case. The case of Israel is the case of truth, the case of democracy, the case of freedom, the case of our civilization, of our roots, of our religion. And therefore, we have to stand with Israel. And a good way to stand is to put our signature on this paper that has been presented to us, and to get many others to do the same. Thank you again, and good evening.
Grazie, Senatore Malan.
Thank you very much, Senator. I would like to now invite you to sign the document. Today is a very special day for Italy. So I would like to invite you to come and sign this document. We will have the speakers sign first. The document will be signed by Senator Pera, and this is a truly important historic moment.
Grazie Presidente. Allora noi come?
La giunta non deve dare le spalle al corso, sì.
Allora ora tocca
che mi change.
Magdi europeo, prima l'Europa e poi l'Italia.
Magdi Alam, l'onorevole Magdi Alam firmerà, prego filmate. È un momento.
This is a truly historic moment. This is going to change the history of Italy. Please sign.
Prego onorevole, grazie.
Grazie, grazie.
Ci telefoniamo e fare una presentazione di questo.
Allora,
vediamo.
Ascente politica, c'è un sacco di amici.
Agostini?
Agostini?
Allora facciamo con lui, verrebbe a Padova. Prego, continuate a filmare perché sarà un momento storico.
They didn't need that. They were both in the trash.
Oh really?
Yeah, yeah.
Show the film.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, it's okay. So it's in a position.
It's you know, people can still
okay.
See how much time he has.
Yeah. Just in the same phrase.
Yeah, he's the same as
him. This very tragedy, because the part Muslim to the peace, not to
the just make these, you know, people can take things. I ask if they want to make a donation, they just put it
in
the box.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think people realize now.
He was interested for petrol.
That's fine. I'm perfectly comfortable. But I think it worked out all right in the end.
Yes, it did.
Fortunately, we didn't. I think Eric took a little bit too long to start with.
So I was now
Anyway.
So, ladies and gentlemen, while you sign and chat, we're going to show a promotional film which is basically summarizing the message of today with Dr. Jacques Gauthier, with former ambassador to the UN, Dory Gold, and Howard Grieve. This is something which will soon be made available on the internet so you can spread the message. We have the young producer here, Leonard Fierre. So just in a moment, we'll see the film.
This is your disc?
Yes.
A Brief Guide, 1925. Yes. This is what you wanted?
Yeah.
This is what you wanted?
Yes. Okay. Because to the, looking for my grandfather had for a
I think it is what I read from here.
The page for number four.
Number four. You have it.
Yeah. This is important for the read. And this is terrorist. This is too much
to the
the futures to frustration, the new Somalia, which will help you for Israel.
I have somebody who wants to me, he's from Somaliland.
Yes.
But another part of Somalia.
I need to balance for a period.
Oh, okay. Well.
So it's possible to return to you.
Yes, you're right.
It's important.
Sure.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Emmanuel, your name?
Pier Giorgio Carinci.
Okay, right.
I am for two Carabinieri.
Oh wow, okay.
Carabinieri,
so write me an email so I
okay. To the right to me.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks. Look in website, then Informazione Corretta.
Yeah.
Like once a week I have an article over there.
Okay.
Yes. Informazione Corretta. Informazione
Corretta.
Dot com or dot com or dot it. It will be so
much. Okay. Thanks so much.
Okay. My pleasure. Man.
Okay.